greatest artists of the last century is having a little revival. Louis Armstrong, the gravelly-voiced singer and maestro of the trumpet, has a new album topping the charts more than 50 years after his death.
Yes, hanging the stocking, I can hear a knocking. Is that you, Santa Claus?
It's a holiday record called Louis Wishes You a Cool Yule. Also, a new documentary called Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues depicts the artist as never before seen, using his own words from his own archive of hundreds of hours of recording.
I got tapes on my wall in my den for 40 years. My life story is right on that wall. And it's about 20 shelves up to the ceiling.
Wow, so powerful to hear his voice. Ricky Riccardi has written two books on Armstrong and is director of research collections for the Louis Armstrong House Museum in Queens. He joins us now. Thanks for being here, Ricky.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Louis Armstrong commanded stages around the world, but when he was at his home in Queens, he taped hundreds of hours of himself talking alone or in conversation with guests. What's the significance of this and other insights the tapes deliver?
The tapes allow you to hear Louis Armstrong talking about music, about life, about people, about New Orleans, about racism, about food. You name it. He wanted the record to show, you know, this is how he lived. And, you know, some people might think, oh, is it from an ego standpoint? Well, I'm sure there was a little bit of that. But the truth is, Louis Armstrong knew that he basically conquered a childhood of poverty and encounters of racism and all this stuff to change the sound of American popular music. One day they were going to write about him in the history books. So why not be in control of his own story?
Was there anything on the tapes that you heard that surprised you?
The most surprising thing for most folks is hearing Armstrong being upset, cursing, because he worked very hard anytime he was in the public spotlight to always be smiling, to be warm. The tapes let you hear those moments where he kind of just puts the smile down and just vents. And it makes you realize this guy was a human being and it was never easy for him for a day in his life.
As we see in the documentary, his career crossed through decades where he broke so many racial barriers, living through a time of really significant social and political change. By the 1960s, younger black artists were looking at him as kind of perpetuating a bygone era, kind of aligning him with the minstrel shows of Forced Smiles and even calling him Uncle Tom. Do you think now that these tapes are out, people are rethinking who Armstrong was because they show him in this fuller light?
Oh, 100%. And I think this was his game plan. He was playing the long game. So in the 30s and 40s, when he was breaking down these barriers, he didn't really speak about it. Yeah, he didn't hold press conferences. He didn't say, today I am the first African-American to host a nationally sponsored radio show. And today I'm the first African-American to star in a Hollywood film with my name above the title. Yeah, he just did it. But he kept his head down, his mouth shut, and just like, you know, on to the next one, on to the next one. And by the 1950s, when the civil rights movement was getting more and more outspoken, at first he did not feel comfortable to come out, you know, and protest. And so he kept those feelings to himself, but he expressed those feelings on his tape recorder. And so before he died, he told his wife, Lucille, don't sell the tapes. Don't throw out the tapes. These are very important. When he dies in 1971, it's front page news, but people were lamenting this genius who sold out and he had to play by white rules. What a kind of waste of talent. And yes, it's taken 51 years after he passed away, but now, you know, he's speaking for himself.
So let's dive into his childhood, Ricky. Armstrong grew up in New Orleans, and he found his calling in music while he was staying at a home for wayward boys. What led him to pick up the trumpet, and what was the influence of being in New Orleans?
Well, the influence of New Orleans was with him for the rest of his life. I don't think a day went by where he didn't think about New Orleans, talk about New Orleans, sing about New Orleans, play songs about New Orleans. But his childhood is frankly kind of terrifying. I mean, his father abandoned him soon after birth. His mother was a prostitute for a number of years. He had to quit school. He was going to school barefoot at the time. He had to start going to work. And, you know, he tells stories about stealing and this and that. So the first time he's arrested at the age of 9 years old is for being a dangerous and suspicious character. But he's in New Orleans, and this is the birth of jazz. The music is in the air. Lewis falls in love with the music. He got arrested on New Year's Eve, 1913, for firing a gun in the streets, just celebrating the new year. It wasn't anything malicious, but he gets sent to this home, basically a juvenile detention center, the Colored Waifs Home for Boys. And to me, it's the greatest arrest in the history of arrests, because without that arrest, Armstrong doesn't pick up the cornet. He spends a year and a half there. He becomes the leader of the band. He parades in the streets and meets all the old timers from his neighborhood and the gamblers and the pimps and the prostitutes and the hustlers. And they're all passing the hat and giving him money. And I think that's when he realized this is it. When he got out, he still had to work all these odd jobs and hard jobs, working on a coal cart and unloading banana boats. But he's practicing every day. And eventually, by the time he's 21, 22, he's got enough of a reputation to be a full-time musician.
You know, he was a founding father of jazz. He comes to prominence in the 1920s, and he also innovates the improvised jazz solo. How did he become what some historians call the first great jazz soloist?
Well, the thing with Armstrong is he really perfects the art of the jazz solo. There were other soloists before Louis Armstrong, but most of the time they just kind of paraphrased the melody. There wasn't much improvisation. In the 1920s, Armstrong is taking long solos, 16-bar solos, 32-bar solos, where he's improvising and he's telling a story. His solos have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and they would usually reach a climax. And, you know, by the end, it wasn't just trumpet players. It was piano players, it was saxophone players, trombone players, you name it, guitar players. They were all listening to Louis Armstrong saying, "This is how you solo."
And then he seems to do a high wire act in song flying above the charts to hit the high C over and over again. Explain what kind of a musical feat that was.
He would end some of his shows by hitting 100, 200, sometimes 300 high Cs, and then he would play a higher F to end on top of it. And so he really extended the range of the trumpet. And this comes from Armstrong's love of opera. When he would buy records, there wasn't much jazz on records, so he would have to buy Enrico Caruso and Amelita Galligherci and Luisa Tetrazzini and all these opera singers who would always have the high notes at the end. And so Armstrong was like, "I want my trumpet to do that."
Now, in terms of his singing, he was an innovator for vocals. He helped create scat singing. He put swing into contemporary vocals. You could draw a line in musical history before and after Armstrong in terms of his vocal styles.
When you listen to American pop singing in the 20s, it's very corny, very stiff. And then he kind of busts the door down, and everything he does swings. He incorporates scat. He incorporates slang. He would take these melodies and make them his own. And that's, again, the blueprint for how to sing, you know, starting with Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby, but right on through every genre of music. If you're singing, even right up to hip-hop today, you're getting your rhythm from Louis Armstrong.
Now, I want to just talk a little bit about, you know, his public stance on issues around civil rights, which he mostly shied away from, and he got a lot of criticism for not being more forthright. But at one critical point, he takes a stand, and schools are being desegregated for the first time. Tell us quickly what happened.
Little Rock is, to me, the defining civil rights moment of Armstrong's career. This is when the Little Rock Central High School was going to become integrated for the first time. And every day on TV, there was mobs of white citizens spitting, yelling, cursing at these 9 African-American students. And Armstrong couldn't take it anymore. The State Department was negotiating to send him to Russia as our representative. And he told the reporter, "The way they're treating my people in the South, the government can go to hell." And he canceled the tour. And this was a time in 1957 when it was dangerous for an African-American celebrity to tell the government they could go to hell.
His song that probably most people know Louis Armstrong for, "What a Wonderful World," it was one of his last recordings. It's a song of hope, of peace, and of just really simple joys.
I hear babies cry, I watch them grow.
What did this song mean for him, and why does it endure today?
Well, for Lewis personally, it was the anthem of his neighborhood in Corona, Queens. Especially the part, you know, "I hear babies cry, I watch them grow, they'll know much more than I'll ever know." He said, "That's it, that's Queens.
I saw 3 generations come up in that block. And they're all with their children, grandchildren. They come back to see Uncle Satchmo and Aunt Lucille. So that's why I can say, I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I can look at all them kids' faces. It is a wonderful world. We have a few jokes. Always have that. But it's still a wonderful world.
Ricky Riccardi, what would you say is Armstrong's legacy today?
To me, he is the entire 20th century wrapped up in one person. Born in 1901, he dies in 1971. He sees world wars and civil rights struggle, the Great Depression. He conquers film. He conquers television. He conquers radio. He conquers the stage. He conquers records. And he's got this whole story, the rags to riches upbringing. It's all there in one man. And his legacy is now stronger than ever.
Ricky Riccardi has written two books on Louis Armstrong and is the director of research collections for the Louis Armstrong House Museum in Queens. Wonderful talking with you, Ricky. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's my story, folks. I guess I'm stuck with it.
It's here and now.
But I can weather the storm.